when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
From the Times and the Sunday Times, this is The Story. I'm Manveen Rana. For months now, students have been gathering on campuses in America, chanting, singing, even the odd bit of drumming, carrying banners and Palestinian flags to protest against the war in Gaza. But just over 3 weeks ago, when the police moved in to clear the protests, they exploded. Violence broke out. And now, almost 3,000 protesters have been arrested, both students and professors.
Is there anything I can do for you right now?
Yes, can you call the philosophy department office and tell them I've been arrested?
Philosophy department?
Yes, call the philosophy department office.
I will. What's your...
Noelle McAfee, I'm chair of the philosophy department.
It led the protests to spread like wildfire in campuses all over America, and France, Germany, the Netherlands, and now in the UK, where the government has warned universities to protect Jewish students from any form of harassment.
Well, he's going to tell those university leaders arriving here in Downing Street that he wants them to take a robust and zero-tolerance approach. It is the same kind of language we heard from the Prime Minister when he talked about those pro-Palestinian marches here in London and elsewhere.
Could this be the moment, like it was in the Vietnam War, when students changed the course of history? We hear from a Jewish professor and veteran of the student protests in 68.
These students are forcing a conversation that nobody wants to have, but that we desperately need.
But are there other parallels with 1968, when the student revolt cost the Democrats the next election, handing power to Nixon? It's clearly a fear for Joe Biden, who yesterday seemed to show he was listening with a new, stronger line on Israel.
Civilians have been killed in Gaza as a consequence of those bombs and other ways in which they go after population centers. I made it clear that if they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah.
Will the protests change America's relationship with Israel? And could history repeat itself in the elections? The story today, why the campus protests could put Trump in the White House.
My name is Josie Ensor, and I'm the Times' US correspondent here in New York. So I cover everything that goes on in New York, but also beyond in the wider US, which in an election year is going to be incredibly interesting.
And Josie, you've been covering the protests at the campuses, particularly in Columbia, which is where obviously it all kicked off. Just describe what it was like. What could you see of the protests?
I arrived sort of a few hours after Hamilton Hall, which is its kind of main historic hall on campus by the lawn, was occupied by protesters. And so by the time I arrived, it had a kind of strange, almost militarized air. They weren't allowing any members of the public, definitely not members of the media. So all the students that were going in had to present ID cards and kind of go through a sort of almost a police barricade. And there were outside protesters just at the gates of the campus. And we were kind of standing underneath the window where the protesters inside had kind of unfurled pro-Palestinian banners. And so it was kind of strange knowing that they were up there barricaded in while we were down there, kind of two levels down on the street.
You are currently participating in an unauthorized
I also bumped into a Columbia journalism student who kind of had wandered over to the cordon, and she was talking to people through this, through the gates of the university. And she was saying, you know, obviously it'd be incredibly exciting for her as a journalism student to sort of be at the centre of the story, which you don't normally are if you're a student journalist. But she was kind of telling me that she hadn't slept, or she'd had half an hour's sleep or something, and she was very hungry and very tired. But yeah,
welcome to journalism.
Yeah, I was like, but welcome to a world of pain that you were about to enter. So I mean, it was quite interesting talking to her and getting her perspective on it all. And she kind of didn't want to leave just in case she couldn't get back in again, as it was quite locked down by the time I'd got there.
We'll talk a bit about some of the students you've spoken to in just a moment. Before we do, just stepping back, give us a sense of how we've got here. You know, you described it being quite militarized. Over the last 3 weeks, campuses across America, you know, it started with Columbia, it's now spread across America and beyond, have been hosting these pro-Palestinian protests, and many of the universities have brought in the police. How has that played out? How violent has it got?
My experience of campus protests has been, it's been largely peaceful. I think some of these things grew organically. Some of them were highly organized. I've been on Columbia campus where there's almost like a festival feel to it, especially with the camps that have been up. But I think, you know, always on the outside of these things, and usually it is on the outside of these things, just outside the campus gates. I mean, you do have a lot of outside agitators, which I think is where these media reports have come from. And, you know, these protests are largely student-led, but, you know, they've been attracting a lot of people both from the local area, but also just staunch activists for the cause. So I think there's always a kind of a chasm between what's happening on campus and what's happening just outside the gates. And I think it's easy to kind of conflate them when you're not there. I think for some of us, it's been strange to watch, particularly Columbia, who seemed to sort of give it a day after the encampments were set up before they sent in the NYPD, that's the city's police. So I think that's why it was quite shocking.
It has looked quite violent. For the students who are still protesting despite that, what's it like? Because, you know, I know some have been camping overnight in freezing temperatures. What are they hoping to achieve by staying put?
This isn't the first time that students have had coordinated action. I mean, we saw it in 1968, which is obviously the kind of anti-Vietnam War demonstrations. For them, they see previous victories on campus where demands have been met in 1968, when ultimately the school decided to distance itself from a weapons research institute involved in the Vietnam War. So they're very informed by those protests.
We will accomplish divestment. We are going to stay here until that. Without divestment, the siege will not end. We need to put pressure now. Historically, this is how it has happened on many universities, and we are going to continue to push for that, and we will not leave.
These protests have been going on for a few weeks now, and they've spread from Columbia to campuses across America and now beyond. We're finding them in Britain. They're spreading across Europe. Describe what's been happening in terms of how the universities have been responding to these protests.
There's been a really diverse reaction from college administrators to this. So somewhere like Columbia, which is sort of known to be the most permissive university for this sort of free speech on campus, they've actually shut down a lot of the protests, which has surprised many. But then you have places like Brown University in Rhode Island, which has actually listened to the students and their demands. And so, you know, they took down their tents the other week after discussions with administrators about divesting away from support from the Israeli military. So you kind of have on the one side an example of what happens when there's more of a dialogue between the students and the college. And then you have places, you know, like the violence we've seen on UCLA.
That's so interesting. And that's really what the students seem to be calling for the universities to divest themselves of Israeli interests and funding for Israeli institutions. It has, in the places where the red states in particular, where it has got quite violent, the police have been called. How has that been playing out?
It's made for quite dramatic footage. And I think, you know, what happened was people saw how quick Colombia was just to send in the police. And the visuals of that were quite strong. I think it prompted a lot of these protests in places like Texas and places like Ohio, where you would just never expect to really see pro-Palestinian protests. And I think, you know, the more imagery there has been like this, the more it's sort of exasperated the situation. And I think in places like Texas, where they've been wearing riot shields and using batons and very violently cracking down on what is essentially in most of these places a peaceful protest, in a lot of the places has kind of inflamed the situation.
You've been speaking to some of the students who are there, who are still there despite the police being brought in, despite the risks that now places them in. Tell us a bit about some of the people you've spoken to.
There's been a real great mix of people. There's some people who the Palestinian cause is their cause. And, you know, they have a long and deep history of that relationship to that sort of protest. Then you have others who have stood up against everything from gun legislation in their state to kind of climate change. And so for them, there's a history of standing up to what they kind of see as unrest. And I think a lot of that has been informed by the last few years in America, particularly with the Black Lives Matter protests, because there is a sort of civil movement society among, I would say, Generation Z behind us that very much live online and they see social media images of what's happening in Gaza every day. And it's kind of become a sort of social media conflict where people have seen everything play out 24/7 through their laptops.
Tell us about one of them in particular. This is Iris. This was a remarkable interview. It made the front page of the Times. Just tell us a bit about her and her background.
Yeah, so Iris, she's 20. She studies climate science and human rights. So she's in her second year. She's from Vermont, a very small town in Vermont. And, you know, she's been a student ambassador. She is one of those people that I mentioned before about someone who stood up against gun legislation in her state. She's very passionate about climate change. It's kind of interesting because she comes from a family where the mother's side of her family are Jewish and the father's side Chinese Asian. So she sees what's happening on campus and she tells me that she's protesting not in spite of being Jewish, but actually because of she's being Jewish. So I found her point of view quite interesting, as, you know, when you have this narrative of people being outside agitators and bringing violence to the campus, and then you kind of have the antidote to that, which is her and a lot of her friends.
It's interesting that she says she felt compelled to protest because she's Jewish. I mean, tell us about that. Explain what she meant, and particularly at a time when, you know, we're hearing so much about the protests being, or some of the protests being potentially anti-Semitic. You know, was that something she'd experienced or worried about?
Yeah, I think, as you said, that she's protesting because she's Jewish, not in spite of being Jewish. And I think a lot of Jewish people feel that there's been a lot of Jewish protesters on campus. There's movements, Jews for Palestine, who feel very strongly that never again, which is, you know, a phrase that Jews use about the Holocaust, never again means never again for anyone, is what she told me. And she sort of, you know, aligns the history of persecution of the Jewish people with what's happening now to the Palestinians in Gaza. And so, you know, she wears the keffiyeh, which has come to denote solidarity with Palestinians. So I think she was kind of keen to get across that this isn't a kind of a group of extremists that are on Colombia and, you know, directing these protests, that there's plenty of people like her who are Jewish and informed by their Judaism.
Does she understand the perspective of some Jewish students, though, that, you know, even if the protests aren't deliberately anti-Semitic, even if they're trying to crack down on anything that is, it still makes them uncomfortable to be on campus?
I asked her that question directly.
What's been your own experience of, do you recognize that in any way from what you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm a Jewish student, and I'm afraid to step on campus because for different reasons, because they had me arrested on campus. But I mean, I also think there's a big conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. And we have seen some, some incidences of anti-Semitism on campus, but those are strongly disavowed by our movement and are not what the movement is about.
Yeah.
She says the safety of one group of people shouldn't come at the expense of another was essentially her answer.
And your interview with her was quite striking. I think a lot of the coverage has been sort of quite eye-rolling about students who always seem to be protesting. You pointed out, though, just how much is at risk? I mean, how much is she paying for the education that might come to a halt if the university suspends her for her protesting or if she does get arrested?
I mean, at Columbia, fees can be up to $66,000 a year, depending on what course you're doing and how many years you're there. But I mean, she understands what's at stake. Her family could afford to send her there, and presumably they saved up, and it might be hard for them to kind of separate their daughter's moral choices from their financial consequences.
I mean, my family is mostly supportive for a Jewish, for a Jewish family. I've got a few family members who are displeased with me at the moment.
Yeah.
But I was raised in a family where justice is something that's really important.
Yeah.
She tells me that she went into this knowing what could happen and what the consequences could be. She kind of imagined that this might happen, that she could, you know, she is still facing expulsion, depending on what the university decide to do with it.
I think that, I mean, I've got my own contingency plans for my life. I would probably, but it would definitely change my life. I went into this knowing that this would change the way my life went, for whatever reason. And I'm okay with that.
One of the quotes that stuck with me, she said, you know, if Columbia keeps taking the stand it does, then I'm not sure that this university can teach me anything.
Coming up, we hear from a professor who's also a veteran of the legendary campus protests of 1968. And could these student protests lose Biden the next election?
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
My name is Mark Nason. I'm a professor of African American Studies and History at Fordham University. I was an undergraduate and a doctoral student at Columbia. I was very active in the Columbia strike in 1968, but I was also very active in civil rights groups on campus before that. I should also mention that I was an athlete at Columbia. I was the captain of the tennis team. So I have a somewhat unusual background for a protester because I was also an athlete.
Mark, as a veteran of Columbia, having been a student there during the spirit of 68, what went through your mind when you first saw the pictures of the protest camps that are going up at Columbia at the moment that are there now? When they first popped up, what did you think?
I was very excited to see that a group of students were peacefully protesting what seems like an emerging genocide in Gaza, and basically saying, we need a ceasefire now, but we also want major institutions to divest from Israel because the only possibility of long-term peace is if there's pressure on Israel to end occupation and apartheid in the West Bank. So I was very excited to see the encampment, see that the students were protesting peacefully. And when the Columbia administration called the NYPD in, I said, here we go again, because nothing does more to expand the protest than calling in the police.
You have experience of that going all the way back to 1968. For people who weren't around then or don't remember the history, just remind us how those protests started and how you got involved with them.
1968 was a pivotal year in U.S. protest history. And I want to remind people of two events which shaped the setting for this. One was the Tet Offensive in the end of January 1968.
In the Vietnam War.
Where many of us concluded this war is being lost and all the people are dying and being killed for nothing. So that was a huge moment when the government's narrative about Vietnam was shattered. Then Dr. King was assassinated April 4th, 1968. There were uprisings in 60 different American cities, including New York. Also, the assassination of Dr. King, for many of us, took away the biggest advocate of a peaceful solution to civil rights and war issues. So a lot of Columbia students who were activists were in a rage, both about the Vietnam War and the racial crisis in America. The protest begins with a rally on the Columbia campus where, for the first time, the biggest anti-war organization, Students for a Democratic Society, and the newly formed Black Student Organization are joining together, protesting against war research on the Columbia campus, and there were 500 people amassing in the central spot on the Columbia campus, the sundial. Now, the plan was to march into the main administration building and kind of occupy it. But there were security guards guarding the building with billy clubs. Now, as an athlete, I'm always put at the front of any protest where there might be physical confrontations. I'm a little bit of a thug. I grew up in a tough Brooklyn neighborhood. And somebody shouted, let's take a building. And we ended up going into the main classroom building, Hamilton Hall, with 400 or 500 people and occupying it.
This house went up on violence and this country's going down on violence. As a house go up, a house must come down.
It's been 2 days. We've taken 5 buildings. Hamilton, Lowe, Avery, Fairweather, and Mann. If you've got the administration figured right, they're up to calling the cops. And when they do, we want to be here.
In the early stages of the occupation, I was speaking to the group as a longtime activist. And I said, every time we decided to protest, we've lost. Now we have Colombia by the balls. Keep squeezing. Don't let go. Which gives you an idea about sort of my way of doing things back in that day.
It's an incredible tale, and it just reminds you of how epic those protests were. But, you know, listening back now, there are so many similarities, I suppose, to what's happening now. You've got the big issues in the background, the big sort of global politics, the Vietnam War, the assassination of Martin Luther King. Students want to feel like they can do something about it. They latch on to issues that they can try and change. For you, watching what's happening now, how much of it feels very similar to 1968, and how much of it is different?
A lot of it feels similar, but there's one big difference, and that is that there's a whole section of the university community which felt personally attacked by any criticism of Israel and saw it as a new form of anti-Semitism. There were all these people in Congress and powerful alumni denouncing these protests as a direct attack on Jewish students, Jewish faculty, and Jewish people generally, even though many protesters in the encampment were Jewish. So this adds a layer of tension to these protests that feels a little different.
For you, as somebody who now is still in academia, you are a professor. Looking back at it now, when you see these protests, does it sort of reaffirm your faith in students speaking up, in holding a belief and wanting to fight for it, having principles? Or do you now view it with the eye of an academic who has to worry a bit about the people who feel uncomfortable on campus because of it?
I think these protests are the only way of creating a path to peace with justice in Palestine and Israel. I think that the only way Israel will ever agree to dismantle apartheid in the West Bank and end this brutal attack on Gaza, if it's put under immense pressure from the United States government, but also private institutions. I have a T-shirt that says, "Not in my name. I'm Jewish." And there are a lot of young people who are Jewish who feel the same way. So even though I think some of the rhetoric of the protest I might not use, I think this is the only way to move the U.S. to try to find a peaceful, just solution. We ended up, with all our faults, helping stop the Vietnam War, creating Black studies programs and ethnic studies programs. Protest is messy. But without protest, the power of government and great wealth goes unchecked. And that's, as a historian, what I see. I'm not saying this is going to happen immediately, but it has to start somewhere. And these students are forcing a conversation that nobody wants to have, but that we desperately need.
And for the students who feel attacked because of the presence of the protests that make them feel uncomfortable, or if they feel that they're being anti-Semitic, what would your message be to them?
I can't tell you that the trauma you feel inside is illegitimate. That's real. And I'm sorry you feel hurt, but try to look at the larger issues here and try to take as much as possible an honest look at what Israel is doing and see if your values allow you to justify that.
One of the lessons of 1968 was that, you know, what was viewed by many people in America as the chaos on campuses with the protests meant the government had lost control of law and order. And it actually pushed the electorate at the next election further to the right, it made them vote in the Republicans. Do you think there is a chance that these campus protests will have the same impact, that these will lose Biden the next election?
Yes. People hate campus protesters, especially at places like Columbia. They see them as a bunch of spoiled rich kids. Even if they may agree with some of what they're saying, they hate the protesters. And I can assure you that we were hated then by most people. And the same thing is true of these protesters. So yes, there is an excellent chance that Donald Trump will be the next U.S. president.
Ironically, that's not what most students would want, we're told. You know, they tend to be more anti-Trump. Is that a price they're willing to pay?
Yes. And let me explain one of the things that is going on here that I don't think a lot of people over 40 understand. The students are getting their information not from news programs. They're getting it from TikTok and Instagram. And they're getting direct images from Gaza that most people never see, of starving children, of corpses lining the street, of hospitals and universities destroyed, of people begging for food. After Tet, the mass media turned on the government and showed us what was really going on in Vietnam. That's not happening now in Gaza. But these students are not getting their information from mainstream media. They're getting it from Instagram and TikTok. So there's this powerful emotional identification with Gaza among many young people on our campuses, especially the most highly educated. And to stop what they see as genocide, they're willing to pay the price of a Trump presidency. Because Gaza is the great moral issue for this generation of students, as Vietnam was for us.
Is there a sense from the people you have spoken to who are still protesting of how long they expect to keep going?
It's a difficult one, because once graduation happens, which for many universities is in the next few weeks and days, you know, I think some of the fire will be taken out of the college campus ones anyway. I think what we might see is campus life giving inspiration to people. You know, the other day I saw protesters, non-student protesters, gathering outside Columbia, because that's kind of become a focal point of people gathering and protesting. So we might see the fire being taken out of the campus protest, but I don't think it's the end. And I think it's been quite instructive to other people. And they've thought this can be something that could possibly affect long-term change, not just on universities, but maybe the way the US government sees it. Maybe this is something that could punish the Democratic Party and Biden in the future going into an election year.
Well, the reason this isn't just a flash in the pan, this isn't just a protest on a campus, the reason it really matters is that this could play out quite significantly in the election. How are these protests playing out for Biden?
I think Biden is very keen to tell people he's not worried. And I think a lot of his team have said publicly, and they perhaps believe and internalize this, that this is a flash in the pan thing. This is something that voters won't remember come November. But from people I've been speaking to, this isn't something that they will just get over before November. I mean, Joe Biden's the nickname Genocide Joe. I mean, it's something of the hypocrisy about it that, you know, they voted a lot of these times, they voted for someone that they thought would kind of stand up for the values that he proclaims. He's an avowed Zionist, as we know. He talks a lot about his long history with Netanyahu and Israel. And what we could see is him really hurt in key states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota, where in the last election they came out and helped him win. These states have large Arab American populations, many of whom kind of understand that voting either against him or for a third option will hurt them and probably hurt them more than anyone else, and are willing to do so. I think a lot of people I've spoken to say that they hope that this sends a message to future US administrations that support for Israel comes at a cost. And, you know, maybe Biden squeaks by this time, but they're hoping that their vote will be heard. And I talk a lot about Arab American voters, but beyond that, there's a lot of progressive young voters who, in their local state elections have been voting. It's called an uncommitted vote, which is essentially a middle finger to the Democratic Party for their stance on Gaza without voting for the Republican. And we've seen this in New York, we've seen this in Michigan, and, you know, people I've spoken to in key states like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin say that they're going to do so in the national election. And so if these votes are taken away from Biden, particularly in states that he needs to win, I mean, it really could cost him. It really could cost him the vote.
This is a powerful moment in American history in terms of how people in the U.S. see Israel. At Fordham, we've had a small number of students who were willing to risk arrest and suspension to create a peaceful Gaza solidarity encampment. People who were going to get awards at graduation, which they now refuse to attend. Many of these young people are the brightest people on campuses, and they are going on to become the professors, the journalists, the leaders of the future. Of that, I am totally confident. This formative experience is going to shape the kind of leaders they are going to become.
That was Professor Mark Nason from Fordham University and Josie Enser, US correspondent at The Times. You can find all the latest coverage of the protests in America and in Britain at thetimes.co.uk with a subscription. The producers today were Priyanka Dalladia and Chris Wade. The executive producer was Kate Ford, and sound design was by Tom Birchall. If you can, do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts, or if you want to get in touch, drop us a line to thestory@thetimes.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Have a lovely weekend.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.